Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, committed to bringing higher finance to lower carbon. Named the most innovative investment bank for climate change and sustainability by The Banker. That's the power of global connections. Bank of America, North America. Member FDIC.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This week on the podcast, I have Bruce Tuckman. He helped bring a number of U.S. channels overseas, number of television channels like Sundance and AMC and MTV and Nickelodeon and a bunch of others global. And we really have a fascinating conversation, especially when we get loose in the podcast portion, talking about the future of video and what it's going to look like. This is an industry very much in flux with both a rich collection of original content. He describes us at peak television, and there's nowhere to go but down from here because it is so overwhelmingly excellent. But the nature of television is changing. The nature of content distribution is not going to be what it used to be, where it's just a fat cable or satellite to your house and you buy a package and that's it. Video on demand, streaming, downloading, these are having major changes on how the industry is progressing, and it's really in a period of dynamic flux. So if you at all are interested in content creation or in how the nuts and bolts of content gets distributed around the world, or really what the state of media is going to look like in 5, 10, 20 years, I think you'll really enjoy this conversation. So with no further ado, my conversation with Bruce Tuckman.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
My special guest today is Bruce Tuckman. He began his career as an M&A attorney at Skadden Arps before entering the world of television, where he helped bring such brands as MTV, Nickelodeon, Sundance Channel, and AMC to a global audience, taking American content to more than 140 countries around the world. Bruce Tuckman, welcome to Bloomberg.
Very good to be here. I appreciate your having me.
So I found your background really fascinating. You're an expert on video content, on modern television streaming and video on demand. So we'll get into Amazon, Netflix, and a whole bunch of related companies in a few minutes. But you began your career as a corporate M&A attorney. How do you go from that to essentially running a handful of television networks?
It seemed less circuitous, I suppose, to me. I always had a passion for the entertainment business. I also had really wanted to. I'd taken time after college. I moved abroad to Spain to develop some of my international business skills, my Spanish language skills. At that point, as a young man living in Spain, I decided grad school may make sense. I was thinking of taking the GMAT or the LSAT. It had been a while since I was doing the cutting edge math that you need for the GMAT.
Right.
So I took the LSAT and I went to law school and I worked for Skadden, and I had a phenomenal training ground and learned a lot. But my passion had always been the entertainment business. And I reached a point in my career there after about 5 years or so that I thought, I don't have kids yet, not married. I could make the shift with less risk. And I really started developing this passion, this idea that if you don't follow through with your passion in life, you're not going to be happy later in life. So I did that and no regrets for that.
So how do you go from Skadden to MTV? That is not a natural career path. Or is it? Was there a transactional relationship with Viacom or anything? And suddenly someone said, hey, you'd be perfect for this?
It's a great question. There isn't that, and it may not seem natural, but what I had been doing back in late 80s, early 90s, I really focused on international M&A and corporate. So I spent a couple of years of my time in Skadden's London office. So I was learning a lot about cross-border transactions. And it just so happened, at that time, pretty much, in the cable and satellite business, these big brands from the U.S. were beginning their international expansion. And they had a lot of great ideas, a lot of creative passion, but they didn't really have a lot of people who knew how to structure one's presence in an international market. How would the media laws and regulations affect a business? How do you structure a joint venture with a foreign partner? So I had those skills. So I came on board originally to spearhead the legal and business affairs aspects of MTV and Nickelodeon's launch into the international markets.
Huh, that's quite interesting. So really, between Spain and London, that was your graduate school for taking television brands, content brands overseas.
It was the beginning, and I had some really amazing insights. I worked on one project in particular, which was the restructuring of News Corp's debt back in the early 90s. That was
So that was for Skadden in the London office. News Corp is, at that point, not really a behemoth in U.S., but huge in the U.K.
And also amazingly taken to task for funding Sky. Sky was their baby that was bringing the whole ship down. Now, we all know what happened. They restructured, and Sky is a behemoth and an incredible business. But it was fascinating being there for the early years of Sky and seeing what that business came to. And it was very eye-opening for me.
Next, along the career path, you ended up taking MGM Networks worldwide. Tell us what that experience was like.
Sure.
How did that start? What obstacles did you run into? What were the surprises along the way?
Sure. So after I spent a year doing legal with MTV, and then I shifted to Nickelodeon to the business side, and I was primarily responsible for spurring the growth and the launch of international channels all over the world. Again, this was a company that had very few, if any, channels outside of the U.S., and with me leading a team and a lot of other good people, we launched this network to 125-plus people.
Was it all at once? You rolled out to 100-plus countries?
I spent a good 6 years working that. And so I learned a lot about the international cable and satellite business. Mm-hmm. It was at its birth more or less then. So I went to MGM after that because I think the challenge I wanted after bringing this great kids network all over the world, I was really passionate about this business of launching new brands, linear, what we call linear now, pay TV networks. Mm-hmm. So I had this opportunity with MGM. And what I loved about it is MGM really did not have anywhere, in just a couple places, branded TV channels. It's a great brand. It's the biggest modern film library in Hollywood, at least at the time. And that was a gaping opportunity that hadn't been covered by MGM.
So before we get too deep into MGM, how do overseas markets for television and video differ from U.S. markets? What's the demand like? What is the taste like? And how does the regulatory and corporate structure compare to what we have here?
Great questions. As you can imagine, every country may be a little different. The international markets were probably a generation behind the U.S. in terms of just rolling out the physical plant.
Uh-huh.
I'll give you an example. In the 90s, when I started bringing channels to India, of all places, cable and satellite was just born. There were no homes. Now, there are more cable and satellite homes in India by far than the U.S.
Mm.
So all this stuff developed very quickly. Every market's a little different, but many, many markets now, you'll find a majority of households have pay TV. Not all markets, but many. Regulatory-wise, as you can imagine, over the years, when this business just emerged, it was a wild west. There are few regulations. Now you look at a lot of markets, it's tougher and tougher by the day. In terms of programming, yeah.
I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My special guest this week is Bruce Tuckman. He was the head of MGM Worldwide Networks, as well as AMC Global, taking U.S. television networks to over 140 countries around the world. Let's before we get into AMC, let's talk a little more about MGM and the massive library of classic and films that they had. What are the tastes like overseas? How did you find the MGM brand played in Asia and Europe? How did that work?
Right. I think overseas, again, depending on the market, you're going to have a combination of two things that work in pay television. Local content, obviously, is big. And I'd say the more removed people are from the English language media markets, the local scene is much bigger. So Japan, Korea, India, that's by far the dominant form of content will be content produced indigenously in local language. But every market in the world, there is room for Hollywood content. It is very popular in larger or smaller degrees, but it's always very popular. Now, what I saw with MGM was the opportunity to take a brand that arguably has some of the most long-term goodwill of any brand. I mean, it is synonymous with film.
How big is that library?
Library at the time was 4,100 films.
Wow.
So the combination of some great films and the brand, well, that's what all pay TV was at that point in time. If you have a good brand, you have good content, that's what subscribers are going to want and what cable operators are going to want, because they don't want to get behind unknown brands, unknown content. It's an easy sell. MGM meant to many people in the world. MGM means great movies, and the movies themselves were great movies. So it was a fantastic run, and we went from about zero channels, and in 10 years, we had tens and tens of millions of subscribers in about 140 countries all around the world.
So now let's talk a little bit about AMC, which over the past couple of years has become a monster brand, not just for what I think of them as American movie classics, were kind of where what they began, but for some really definitive original content. So how was the AMC brand different than MGM, and how did it play overseas?
Well, a couple of interesting things. So I think for the core demo, perhaps that is right now watching Walking Dead and have watched Breaking Bad.
Don't forget Mad Men, right?
And
that
Mad Men.
Also another one.
I'd say...
By the way, those are three pretty much definitive original programs over the past 10, 15... You know, throw in The Sopranos, it's hard, and then Seinfeld the decade before that. That pretty much dominates what people have been at least talking about.
I agree. You know, you don't sell Game of Thrones short either, but it was brand defining, obviously, for AMC Network. And I think a lot of the people watching it now, that demo may not even remember American movie classics. They think of AMC
right.
in those terms.
It's Walking Dead and Breaking Bad.
And all
not bringing up Baby. That's not the thought process.
That's correct.
So that raises the question, how important is the development of original content to a branded channel like AMC?
Huge. There have been evolutions in this pay TV market. It used to be dominated by libraries, second-run library content. If you think about even HBO and Showtime in the earlier years, it was the second run, perhaps, of movies.
It was movies, and it was stand-up comedy specials, and that was pretty much it.
Correct. So the market got more and more competitive, and original programming became necessary to distinguish a channel from others in a more competitive market, and especially now with the slowing and, in fact, declining subscriber universe, you got to do everything you can to reach a big audience, and you just can't cut corners by showing cheap reruns anymore. That will not work. So that's the state we are in now with having to invest in all this original programming.
So a question that I had that I think is, I imagine other people would also, is how similar is the taste of consumers of film and television watchers overseas to us in the United States? Does Don Draper play overseas? Is that the sort of thing? Does Walter White have a resonance in Japan? You know, these are really definitive U.S. characters on all ends of the spectrum. How are these shows and how are these characters accepted in other markets?
Correct. For I'd say the last 6 or 7 or 8 years, the what we're calling peak TV or the drama renaissance, this is a global phenomenon.
Not just here in the United States,
not
the
just
golden
here.
Age of television isn't a U.S.
Yeah, and
only
golden
phenomenon.
Age of television may have, there. I think there's more nuance to that, but the top quality dramas produced in the English language are really romping around the world.
Mm-hmm.
So you can go.
Tell us what's big overseas right now.
Well, I mean, Game of Thrones is huge.
Really?
Walking Dead, Stranger Things from Netflix has done incredibly well in terms of seeing what the global demand for that is. Mr. Robot's doing terrifically.
No kidding.
Yeah, so these shows are really hot all over the world. Now, it depends on the market. Do they dominate every market like they do in the U.S.? No, not necessarily, because as I mentioned before, a place like India has an incredible local production industry. They're broadcasting original programming developed in India in a dozen different languages. However, these shows break through. These dramas break through in every single market all around the world. May not happen 5 years from now, but we have been in this phase of the business for the last, I'd say, 8 or so years where this is working.
Let me throw a curveball at you. I remember moving out of the city to the suburbs a dozen plus years ago and not being happy that I couldn't get BBC America, which I was used to when I lived in Manhattan for 20 years. So I had to go to a satellite instead of the local cable. Now yeah. It's everywhere. But I recall shows like Doctor Who and Top Gear really being global phenomena.
Yes.
A dozen years ago. Was the BBC the first network to really take themselves global? Did they set the original model for this?
I think the pioneers were both the major Hollywood studios that have always had incredible sales arms for their TV and movie production all around the world. And BBC, I would also put up in that category, especially within the Commonwealth nations. BBC was always an important brand and always had an extensive network of channels and programming, and they put a lot of money, resources into getting that stuff all around the world.
I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My special guest today is Bruce Tuckman. He is a former M&A lawyer from Skadden Arps who entered television and ended up taking over a number of channels such as Sundance, AMC, MGM, and bringing them global to over 140 countries. You're on the board of advisors of Parrot Analytics.
Sure, I'm a board member.
Board member. Yep. Let's talk about what it means to try and measure audience. In the U.S., we have Nielsen ratings, which has been a lot of criticism and complaints that it doesn't capture time shifting. It doesn't capture a lot of things. What's it like trying to measure viewership overseas?
Well, I think it's funny. Even today, after this election, we're seeing that taking a sample like Nielsen does. Mm-hmm. Nielsen has 30,000 or so paneled homes, only recently stopped using paper to document what people are watching. And they're extrapolating from that what people are watching. That is part of the basic underlying concern about extrapolation-based, panel-based surveying of TV audiences.
We get so much information on the web,
right,
about website performance. We could track how long people are on a site, where they're coming from, how quickly they bounce off, where they click on the page, how many different things they
Correct.
Look at. It would make sense that there should be some technology that does that on the video side.
Well, sure. And that's what Parrot Analytics is doing. So if you think about the internet's a huge billion, 3 billion, 3.7 billion people are using the internet. Every day, if you think about what you may be doing, if you like a show, we mentioned Game of Thrones before, you may press a like on Facebook, you may read about Jon Snow on Wikipedia, you may follow something on Reddit, post something. You may even, this happens a lot of markets, illegally download 4 hours. So a company like Parrot, mm-hmm. Parrot is listening and scraping to all of these messages in the internet, listening at everything, but more importantly, weighing it all. If you download 4 hours and pirate it of Game of Thrones, you're pretty passionate about a show. If you're liking it on Facebook, you like the show, but maybe not as much. Now, if you weigh all that together, you could come up with a real, actual, genuine amount of data that people are expressing demand for TV shows, which I think is far more compelling than just having surveys where you're extrapolating.
But don't we run into potentially the same problem that, hey, we're not actually measuring votes, but we're surveying, we're looking at what people say and do about candidates or about shows, and trying to draw a conclusion about it from that model?
The difference is there's no conclusion being drawn. It's empirical. It is, okay, we've measured now a billion data points. These are powerful computers, and this is the facts. No conclusions or extrapolation to be drawn. This is what people are saying right now. So this is going to revolutionize the business. It's going to happen more and more. Obviously, I think a lot of these data measurement companies now are good complements to Nielsen. There are $60 billion of transactions going on based on Nielsen, but at some point, the data has to come in and inform a little bit.
So let's talk a little bit about that big data. How can we use big data and analytics to figure out how valuable specific content is?
You can, because you can see what people are saying out there, and it's not only see what people are saying empirically, you actually can see who they are, what their demographics are. You can find out what products they like. You can say, wow, this Game of Thrones person, I can see this person. I can see this person also likes Lincoln Motors and also likes Dan and Yogurt. So we're only at the beginning of all of that. And I think over the long run, a paper-based survey is still based on essentially Johannes Gutenberg's ideas.
It's
going to be very different.
Is the technology consistent between the U.S. and overseas? Can you generate the same sort of analytics? And is it as accurate there as here or vice versa?
Yeah, because, I mean, it's a global phenomena, the web.
There's no cultural differences from the U.S. to Europe to Asia?
No, I mean, when you're just measuring what people are watching by using the internet and using these sources where people are expressing their demand for TV, you're just finding what people are really saying. So it's young, this industry, but it's powerful. Each year it evolves even stronger and stronger.
I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My guest today is Bruce Tuckman. He has taken a number of U.S. television channels worldwide to over 140 countries. Let's talk a little bit about streaming and video on demand and what that means. You know, when I was a kid, we had the three networks and a handful of syndication, and by the time I got to high school, this thing called HBO came along, and we had movies and curse words and stand-up. It was revelatory. Today, there's content from everywhere. You have not only the networks, but all the pay channels. There seems to be everybody producing their own content. I'm a huge fan of FX, AMC, IFC, there's a whole run of shows that are spectacular. That's before we get to Netflix, Amazon Prime. I'm sure I'm forgetting others. There's just an embarrassment of riches when it comes to original programming. Is this really a golden age of television, and how long can this last for?
Yeah, they call it peak TV, but I call peak TV in a way that it's peaked.
It's already peaked. We're already past the peak.
Well, I think it's just a matter of time, and I'll explain why. There's about 500 original narrative dramas going to be produced in the U.S. this year.
500.
You can never absorb all that. That's probably around three times as much as when Mad Men came out 7 or 8 years ago.
Really?
Yeah. So what there is, like any business, I suppose, there's a copycat phenomenon because the success of AMC, FX, even what HBO and then Showtime and Starz Encore is doing, people have realized quality dramas not only rate, they define brands. They start the conversation in the morning. They add incredible value. So everyone's rushing to it. Is that sustainable is the question. I don't think it's sustainable because people aren't watching all of this stuff anyway. You're finding overall, with a few exceptions like perhaps Walking Dead or Game of Thrones, you're seeing ratings decline. You're seeing the overall cable universe decrease by now what's becoming scary, significant single-digit percentages each year. And you're seeing advertising go down. So the economic basis, especially for basic cable TV, the overall revenue pool is declining. To keep investing in this high-quality drama is not going to be sustainable. So I think that's going to shrink.
What is this, the cord-cutting phenomena of basically the millennials who aren't enthralled with the whole run of channels they get with a cable package? They just want internet service, and they'll buy what they want on demand and not work. What does this mean to the future of the content industry and Is this why you think we're post-peak TV?
Yes, I think so. I think the basic cable bundle is under the most pressure because there's cord cutting, cord shaving. You've seen...
Cord shaving, meaning you don't fully cut it, but you just go to the basic...
I want less stuff. Why do I want all the three premium movie services when maybe I just want HBO and I'll get Netflix? Or, you know, that could be one thing. Or new household formation, younger people aren't bothering. But the fact just that it's shrinking, even by single percentage digits, this is an industry that has never seen that before. Uh-huh. It's a very hard learning curve to learn how to adapt to that.
And this isn't going to get better. This is only going to get worse as the millennials, the pig moves through the python, so to speak.
It's going to get worse. And for basic cable, nothing's looking good in the right direction because there's too many basic cablers in this original narrative drama space. Their revenue base is shrinking. The competition's intense, and at the same time, the format isn't so great. When you're breaking a show for commercials every 15 minutes sometimes, you're conforming your storytelling to what may be a very antiquated format.
Eight minutes, six minutes, seven minutes.
You got to build a little peak, and then you go away right. for 4 minutes. Now, if you look at what's going on Amazon or Netflix, they don't care about the length of the show. 40
right.
minutes. They're telling 36
minutes, right.
And they're telling a story, and the stories are compelling, and they don't break off. So I think both from a creative standpoint, business model standpoint, basic cable's in big trouble. The a la carte networks, the streamers are in much better shape.
Uh-huh.
And younger people seem to find them convenient, but so do older people as well.
I have to ask a question about the commercials and what you've defined. I mean, other than the Super Bowl, I don't remember watching a commercial in the past decade.
Right.
Every television has a DVR on it. They're now 4,000 hours big. They're giant. I assume everybody else uses DVRs. And all you do is, if you want to start something, even if it's not on DVR, you pause it, you do 15 minutes worth of chores, and now you have no commercials to worry about.
Certainly, live viewing is shifting more and more each year to DVRs or getting catch-up on demand on your cable system, downloading something from iTunes that you've missed. That's happening more and more. It's really going to be hard to stop that. That is a challenge that's profound for the industry, and there doesn't seem to be a solution around that.
Let's talk about the DVD. For you youngins out there, they actually used to put video content on these round silver discs. I think you could still buy them at various stores. Is that over, or is the DVD finished, or is this going to be a format and Blu-ray and 4K and everything else? Is this going to have any sort of legs?
Sure. It will get harder and harder, obviously, in smaller quantities to manufacture at economies of scale this kind of technology. However, I look at some markets like Japan. I mean, Japan really has a robust DVD business and seems to be a part of a lot of people's lifestyle. Go to the corner DVD store each night and pick something up.
Don't they have a robust album, like an LP, the full 33s? I think that's, and as well as CDs, they haven't moved away from the physical content.
There is that. And let's face it, there's very few forms of predecessor media that completely vanishes. People are still buying radios, right?
Right.
They still do. It's not as big a business. You can go, though, into any Best Buy or Radio Shack around here and probably buy a transistor radio. Now, they're going to have to produce less at better prices, so I don't think it necessarily goes away right away, but it's obviously fading, and it will over time.
Let's talk about the difference between streaming versus downloading. So when you download something, you essentially own it or
right.
rent it for a period of time versus just streaming on demand. How are those two businesses different, and is either of those likely to become the dominant methodology, or are they going to coexist?
They have to coexist, and I think download is getting a dangerous short shrift, by which I mean, it used to be my personal frustration as a guy on planes a lot,
yes.
is with Netflix. I can't download anything. I can't watch anything. I can't stream in an airplane. We all get frustrated about that, but that is, let's say, an elitist problem,
yes.
maybe.
That is very much a first world issue.
But you know what? It's a bigger third world issue. You know what I'll tell you? Because think about this. In a developing world, it costs a lot of money to stream. bandwidth is actually really slow, yet on-demand content's really valued. So what a lot of people are doing in countries that represent 1, 2, 3 billion people, they'll go, for instance, to a mall where there's free Wi-Fi. They'll watch there, but where they can download, that's where they download. So they download everything for free, go home and watch it. So the idea of even temporary downloads is so necessary for the long-term health of the streaming business, and not just to please your consumers. I mean, if you're in Dubai or if you're in Thailand and you're paying $40 in data charges to download, you're going to be upset at your provider. But I would also say for the studios, the producers of content themselves who get wigged out about downloads, if you don't offer temporary downloads to your paying streaming customers, it'll be pirated then the next day. So you make the choice.
Really?
Well, yeah, because if something is available at a reasonable cost, you're already subscribing to a streaming service,
right,
and it's their day and date with the debut of the show in the U.S., you'll get it on your streaming service and everyone gets paid in the value chain. And if it's not there or you can't download it and you're going to have to pay a fortune to stream it and you're never going to do it because the quality of streaming is bad anyway, someone's just going to go home on their connected broadband and pirate it.
So let's talk about piracy. How significant is piracy? How serious do you think piracy is to the content producing side of the world?
Look, it's huge, and there's all different stats on measurement, but it hasn't stopped the producer of Game of Thrones being in business. They're making a ton of money. It's just how much more money should they be making? I don't know, nor does anyone know the answer, but some of the solutions are, for instance, I think iTunes did a great job of offering really an easy interface, a fast download at an affordable price, which kind of made it almost a no-brainer. You know, I don't care. Let's not rip it off because it's really painless.
It's a couple
to do
of bucks, $5 for a movie. Why wouldn't you do that?
And it's $0.99 for a song.
Right.
The video business has to be doing that. You have to offer people, most importantly, big shows literally simultaneously day and date all around the world. If Game of Thrones is here at 10 p.m. one night, and they're doing this now, it's got to be shown everywhere else.
Otherwise,
around the world.
Someone will pirate it here and send it over there.
Right. Yeah, or pirate it over there because it's all connected now.
We've been speaking with Bruce Tuckman. He used to run MGM Global and AMC International, bringing a number of U.S. channels to 140 different countries around the world. If you enjoy this conversation about video streaming and on-demand, be sure and stick around for our podcast extras where we keep the tape rolling and continue chatting about all things television. Be sure and check out my daily column on BloombergView.com or follow me on Twitter at Ritholtz. We love your comments and feedback. Be sure and write to us at mibpodcast@bloomberg.net. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You've been listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.
Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch. Seeing what others have seen, but uncovering what others may not. Global research that helps you harness disruption. Voted top global research firm 5 years running. Merrill Lynch. Pierce Fenner and Smith Incorporated.
Welcome to the podcast. Bruce, thank you so much for doing this. This is really quite interesting.
My pleasure.
When we first met and talked about what you did, I was very much intrigued, not just because I'm kind of a classic film fan and really a television idiot, but the idea of taking U.S. content and saying, let's turn this into an international business is really quite fascinating. So let's see what questions I missed before we jump into our favorites. Sundance. We really didn't talk about Sundance Channel, which I wanted to. So the original Robert Redford Sundance Festival eventually became a channel, and I kind of remember the line, something about honoring Robert Redford's mission to celebrate distinctive storytelling from independent voices. Is that more or less the...
That's correct, and I think he's always said it best. And I would add to that, because what he's always also said is, that's not otherwise being heard in the mainstream media.
That makes sense.
That's what drove me in terms of the Sundance International expansion. They're doing different things now in the U.S. that I didn't run, I won't speak to, but... that propelled, just in 3 years, I was able to take, with my team, that channel from a couple of countries to about 80 countries around the world with that in mind. When you think about it, the U.S. Majors are producing maybe 100, 120 films a year. Mm-hmm. And that's what dominates the pay movie TV channels all over the world. Yet at Sundance alone, there's thousands of independent films that are submitted. So
wait, 120 U.S. mainstream films per year.
Feature films.
And just submitted to the festival, there's over 1,000
thousands,
films each year.
Thousands. And that's just Sundance. So what's, I think, happening and what Robert Redford was speaking to is so much more content is being produced independently and it's not getting its, let's say, strict fair share of the airtime. Now, some of the content may not be great, and a lot of the Hollywood film content is not great either. But I think what allowed us to expand so much and get so much real estate with cable operators all around the world was just simply that premise. You're missing a lot of great content, and it's actually not that expensive compared to what you're paying for some of the Hollywood film content. And it's just going to add to a diversity of voices, and we'll bring in a lot of, and what we did a lot around the world, we brought in a lot of local independent films.
So when I think of Robert Redford, he's an icon. Here we are, post-election, and everybody had, on Twitter, had the shot of The Candidate, which was a very famous film of his. You know, that Now What scene.
What do we do now?
Right? Yeah. That's exactly it. So I saw that last night go around. Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, go down the list of films that he was active in. They're just an amazing run of movies, but it's such an American brand. Does that play overseas, or am I imagining that people overseas are more different from us than perhaps I should?
It plays overseas in that if there's any brand that's synonymous with independent film,
right,
it's Sundance. Now, will your run-of-the-mill guy walking down the street in some country 2,000 miles away know Sundance? Maybe, maybe not. But I think everyone, there's a big market wherever you go for independent film, especially independent film that features stories and characters from your own country that isn't just the mass package commercialized stuff you're getting out of Hollywood. So that helps. But particularly in this business of channels, you're selling to usually big cable operators. And the people running these big cable operators are very sophisticated. They've been to Sundance. They're very familiar with it.
So let's talk about AMC a little bit. We were talking earlier about Walking Dead and Mad Men and Breaking Bad. By the time you joined AMC, I'm doing this from memory, I'm guessing Mad Men had already been in production for a while.
Correct.
And Breaking Bad was just starting.
Yeah, yeah.
And then towards the latter end, that's when Walking Dead came.
Exactly.
So as this first comes out, do you have any idea what sort of a giant cultural impact these are going to have? And how do you think about taking that and applying it to overseas markets?
Yeah, that's a great question. Mad Men certainly was...
By the way, that is such an... iconic, like, just when you think of that late 50s, early 60s era, and Don Draper has become an archetype now. That archetype of you know, the hard drinking, three martini lunch, smoking, womanizing sort of guy, again, does that play overseas, or is it such a cliche that they eat it up overseas?
No, it plays overseas. And interestingly, that guy now... And his acolytes won the election last night. I don't mean him.
I mean, by the way, as I was saying that, I was going to say something witty about that sort of hard drinking, hard smoking, womanizing. Although Trump doesn't drink, you know, he famously is a teetotaler. But that sort of presidential candidate, and I thought better of it. But since you brought it up, when Bush was president, and you traveled overseas. There was a sense that he was really looked at as a cowboy. He's from Texas, goes from the gut, invades various countries. There was really a stereotypical American perception of Bush that way. So how do you use how the world perceives the United States? As much as they may on occasion criticize us or dislike us or argue with us about different things, they seem to, overseas seems to love American culture.
They love American content. It's been interesting in my career because my international career started with Reagan in office. So Reagan and Bush, and I suppose Trump, it does become difficult just in casual conversations with people often. It wasn't like
meaning,
that.
So my personal experience is you fly into Berlin from New York, and I recall trips to London as well. And there was a very diffident, if that's the right word, cool, an American. Like a real, at customs, yeah, Canadians were always nice. You go to Montreal or Vancouver or, you know, they seem to be very friendly to Americans. But the Europeans were certainly post the Iraq invasion. There was definitely a little bit of a chill. And part of you is like, am I imagining this? And then once Obama was elected and you went overseas, it was a completely different, oh, come on in. It was a whole different attitude. And I was like, I recall going back to Berlin and back to London and thinking, you know, it wasn't my imagination. They're much nicer now than they were the last time I was here when it was a different president. So we have no idea what the rest of the world is going to be like when it comes to Trump, other than nervous.
I think we have a good idea because you hear a lot. I have a lot of friends abroad. I do a lot of business abroad. I often find you have to defend and explain U.S. policies for good or for bad. Bill Clinton was also very popular. That's just what it is. But when we're in that position of people think there's bad developments in the U.S., that does from time to time wind up impacting the political environment of a country you're operating, which sometimes bleeds into the regulatory environment, which sometimes makes it a little harder
really?
To get your stuff done.
So that I imagine that, and then part of me, again, it's like, now you're being paranoid. That's not really
well. I'll give you an example. So,
okay.
So the EU, especially with the UK out, I imagine is going to get more aligned with the French and German point of view in terms of regulation of media, which is much stricter than where the Brits have always been, where the Americans always been. So that will get tighter and tighter. You need diplomacy between the US and the EU if that's lacking, and they're not going to listen to our entreaties to say, loosen up these regs, loosen up,
not
make them
happen.
More favorable. It's not going to happen. So that's where—
What are the regulations like? So just between the US and the UK, we know their libel laws are very different. They're much stricter in the United States. If you're slandering a public figure, you actually have to show malicious intent.
Yeah.
You know, it's an excuse to say, oh, I was innocently wrong. I read it on Facebook or whatever. In the UK, there isn't that. It's a much stricter. You're telling me go to France and England and it's even stricter?
Well, what I was talking about was content restrictions or licensing regulations rather than libel. I can't speak to libel or
slander.
So let's
talk about content.
Well, let's talk about privacy.
Okay.
On the other hand, they're much stricter.
We've seen that with Google, with Google searches.
Yeah.
You have to delete people's searches in France, which is certainly not the case here. I don't know how Facebook deals with that in Europe.
Right. So I think as we try to harmonize these regimes, especially for technology that knows no borders, less strict regime here in the U.S., more strict within the EU. I don't know which way Trump will go on this, but the point is governments have to talk about that. And if governments are not getting along, they don't agree with each other, and that's a big challenge that we face.
Huh. That's really fascinating.
But on the other hand, ironically, things may get easier with Russia, which has become very regulated in terms of media. It didn't used to be that way. Savings grace, I don't know that offsets everything else.
Well, when you say regulated, do you mean, you know, killing journalists, or do you mean their actual—
So just for my business— linear TV business, funny quick story. In 1996 or 7, I believe, I did a deal. I launched the Nickelodeon channel in Russia, in Russian, in their emerging pay TV business. It was 1 million, 2 million subscribers. I'm so proud of that. I went there for launch. It really meant a lot to me. And at that time, I didn't need a broadcast license. I didn't need any interference at all or anything to do with the media authorities. Now, 20 years later, you need several broadcast licenses. You cannot own a majority of your own brand.
Right.
And the reason, so all of these regulations over time have gotten stricter and stricter. What gets them less strict or more accommodating to U.S. interests is really through our trade reps, our diplomats, who try to negotiate things that work across the board. So my kind of joke is, it may get easier with Russia, because
so
that's about it, though.
That's a really interesting point, and we really haven't talked about the 800-pound gorilla in the room, which is China. What's it like bringing television to China? Do they want U.S. content? How easy are they to deal with? Piracy seems to be rampant there. Tell us about China.
U.S. content, too, is hugely popular in China. Local Chinese content is more popular, but China has a fascinating business, which no one even appreciates, and you don't see it in other countries, but I call it AVOD, or advertising video on demand, or free video on demand.
How does that work?
There are five or six different sites.
Yeah.
You can put on your laptop. You can get an app for your TV. You can watch on your mobile device. You go, literally, it's free, and it features first-run, day-and-day programming often from U.S. studios and everything else. And you watch it, and it's ad-supported.
Really?
So instead of like Netflix, and it could be the same.
So that's the YouTube model, or theoretically the Yahoo model.
It is the YouTube model because it's ad support. It's the only market that can probably do that because it's so big.
And nobody, so it makes sense. It's, you have to have volume in the U.S. Again, first world issue. We would rather pay up for the premium model or the technology like a DVR to go bypass the advertising. They're happy to take it because it's free.
I think that could be it. Yes, absolutely.
It is now, as they start to make more money, are they going to have the same issue that we have, where a little bit of wealth and people become impatient and they don't want
to
watch?
To be determined. But what's happening in China now, because the wealth really has to get there, a lot of this viewing is on probably even better working Xiaomi devices. You know, very good handsets.
Tablets, handsets.
And a lot of people are watching that way, especially a lot of the young people. They may not have two or three TVs in their homes, so that's how a lot of content is being watched.
And they have more money. They have more time than money, so they're happy to do it if it's free.
Sure.
Huh. That's quite fascinating. What, before we get to our standard questions, let's what else can you tell us about China that we probably don't know?
I think there's questions, obviously, about the macro economy in China, the banking system, but at least what
the
I
debt,
see—
huge amounts of debt. But I mean, from what you do, what do you see there?
Booming.
Booming.
Entertainment booming.
Really?
It will soon be the largest movie market in the world.
It's not already? I just assume, given the number of people.
It's about to cross that threshold. Obviously, that has already changed so much if you think about what's being shown in our own theaters.
I read a while ago that because the overseas rights are so valuable, that very often when there is a expensive film to be made, even the storyline has to be built so that it's going to be a winner in China, and you pre-sell the foreign rights before you even make the film. So where it used to be perhaps that the Chinese was the bad guy, now it's a Cold War enemy, it's the Koreans, it's the Russians, it's somebody, not, it's evil China. You're not going to have that made.
If you're producing a mass market movie where you want to break the bank in terms of box office, if you're not thinking about how things are going to go over in China, you've just cut off nearly half of your potential revenue, or at least that's the way we're going. So why would anyone make that business decision? Sort of like making a car and deciding, I will not ever put the driver's, the wheel on the right side for the driver.
So you give up the UK, you give up Japan, you give up any of the UK territories.
Australia,
right.
You got to adapt. Yeah.
I think it was in Anguilla, where we rented a car and they pull it around, and I'm like, oh, that's right.
Exactly. And you ever drive that for the first time?
Yeah, oh yeah. You just basically, my rule of thumb was just make sure that you're, what was worse was we were driving a left-hand drive on the, that was the car. It showed up where they pull up on the wrong side of the road.
Yeah.
With the left hand. So my thing was just make sure that the curb is next to me. So in the U.S., the curb is next to the passenger. Now you have to be, so wherever you go. And lefts and rights got to be a little confusing. It's really easy.
I'm still amazed that they will let you drive instantly, because I think for people who haven't done it before, I'm not sure if they're worse drivers drunk or if they're worse doing that. It's very dangerous.
I was going to say, sober, it's not difficult. But you go to a dinner, you have not even drunk. You have a drink or two with dinner, and you're a little – We went to this place, and I drove back from it. And the first 5 minutes of the drive back, I'm on the U.S. side of the road, and I was sober enough. You know, a drink with dinner is not going to – someone my size is not going to make me that compromised. But for the first – it feels like 5 minutes. It was probably the first 30 seconds. Oh, gee, I'm on the wrong side of the road. I have to get on the right. By the way, what country was it? Sweden, that they stopped at noon and reversed the sides? I don't remember if it was Sweden or somewhere else, but literally everybody stopped one day.
But my point is a drunken person driving in the U.S., all right, shouldn't be driving, and they're dangerous. And a neophyte person who's never driven on the other side of the road in the U.K. is also a dangerous person.
Right. Maybe and they not quite as dangerous, but it could be close.
And then trying a stick shift with the left hand.
A stick shift is easy, but you make the turn and – you know, your brain goes through a certain set of muscle memories, especially a left turn here is a right turn there, and it's just too easy to make the turn and end up on the wrong side. That's how I ended up in the wrong side of the road. You come out of a driveway, and it makes sense from a restaurant, makes sense to stay, but I digress. So I don't know how we got to that point, but it's...
Oh, the Chinese film market and how...
Yeah, you can't ignore it.
It comes.
This is really going to drive content. China's going to help drive content for the future.
Of course.
So I know I only have you for a finite amount of time.
Okay.
Let's jump to our standard questions.
You got it.
And you know, I only briefly talked about you at Skadden Arps. So you're at Skadden Arps. You're doing M&A work. How did you end up? What was the transition from lawyer to television channel executive? How did that come about?
You know, you become a more senior associate, as I have been doing, and you get to the point, if you're doing well, you run your first or second big deal, and it's exciting, you learn a lot. Meet a lot of people, but then you realize, you know what, I'm going to be doing this around the clock for another 4 or 5 years, if I can become partner. I've learned a lot, but I've always been driven just by passion. Uh-huh. And I didn't want to give up that opportunity. So it took a determined effort. This was before the internet. I sent out cold, hard copy resumes.
You looked for it. Really?
Yeah. I really...
And you had done enough television-related work that you had an expertise in it, and you could talk about B Sky B and everything else.
Yeah, but more so I did a lot of international work, which I think was even more valued, because uh-huh. there's plenty of people who know television at the time, at least in terms of TV branded channels. They're warning out a lot of people who knew how to set things up internationally.
So you're sending mail out. You're coming from a firm with a great reputation. Who was the first entity that?
So I got a MTV Networks, among others, said, come on in. And I was thrilled. I was a young man. I was 30 maybe. And I'm like, this is the coolest thing.
Right. MTV way back in the 80s and 90s, MTV was as hip as it got.
I just wanted the business card. I just wanted that business card. And I tell my kids now, because things are different, I say it was the Google then. You just got to understand. It's like what you think of Google now.
In terms of hipness, that might be – there was a period of time where MTV was huge.
Yeah.
Absolutely huge. And around that time was when you took them international.
Yeah, I mean, I helped. I was I was coming up in my career then, so I was part of a team that really did that. But it was great work because MTV was so influential in my life because it came right at that. You know, I was 17 or so when it came out.
Right.
And
that's about right. We're about the same age.
Yeah, and that was, you know, that was my home base for years up until I probably had kids, and then it became news channels. But
So what do your kids find cool and hip today that's the MTV of the modern era? Is it Snapchat? Is it things like that? Or
I hope my 13-year-old won't get mad at me for this story, but she once said to me, Dad, I want a TV in my room. I go, why? You don't watch TV. She goes, well, Jordan, her older sister, has one. I go, yeah, but you don't ever watch it. She goes, yeah, right. I just want a big iPad on my wall.
And that's what she's looking at is.
Yeah, so there's so little linear watching going on, and it's just not my kids. It's
the generation.
It's the generation.
There's no doubt about that. So you mentioned you were part of a team. Let's talk about your mentors. Who mentored your career?
You know, I had a handful of people have really inspired me throughout my career. So I wasn't one of those kind of people who've traveled through my companies with a boss who got moved to these other companies.
Right.
I forged that on my own. But big inspirations to me at Skadden, there were two attorneys in particular, a guy named Finn Fogg, who was a big M&A guy from the 80s and 90s, not just a brilliant lawyer, but I learned from him how to be cool as a lawyer, just how to be charismatic, what's important, what isn't.
They don't teach that in law school.
They don't teach that in law school. So I really learned a lot from him. Another attorney there, Nancy Lieberman, really taught me the value of how hard you have to work for perfection, that it's not good enough, that you can't have a typo. You shouldn't have a typo. People are paying you a lot of money, not just for your substance, but everything else. I learned a lot from her.
Really?
I think I was also inspired a lot by, when I worked at MGM, Alex Yemenagian, who was Kirk Kerkorian's right-hand man, who ran the studio. Just a very good faith man who believed a lot in the principles he espoused, looked out for his people, but also challenged people and had ran a tight and a smart ship. Tom Freston inspired me at MTV Networks because I just think is the first time I saw someone who always put creative first. But that made sense because, you know, these are a lot of people treat the media business like their businesses. They get too focused on the balance sheet and the P&L without realizing you got to make the product hot and you got to make the brand hot and you got to value those kind of people who can figure that out.
I just finished reading. We'll get to books in a few minutes, but I just finished reading To Pixar and Beyond by the former CFO who was Lawrence Levy, was recruited by Steve Jobs to basically come rescue Pixar. And amongst other things, he said their secret sauce was how the corporate side, how the finance side essentially left the creative alone. And it was actually built in to the corporate culture and the entire structure. Hey, the geniuses who are creating Toy Story, you can't mess with that. No notes, no, you know, movie executive saying, hey, can we bring in a girl to this, you know, a toy to be Woody's friend or whatever it is, the sort of nonsense that you hear about with that. It's that same concept of you have to keep the creative side separate.
It's still art. And I would ask you, look at any media company right now and their story and where they are in their evolution and their arc. And more often than not, you can explain it as to who's ruling the house. Is it the right brain or the left brain side of the brain?
So when you see a mediocre television show, when you see a film, do you ever look at it and say, oh, you could see the accountants messed around with this?
Definitely. You can see all the compromises.
The suits got
the
involved.
The suits or whatever, or when it becomes so obvious why they skimped on this character or they put that in or whatever. And that's the challenge for movies because sometimes, you know, it looks that way. Not always. I have one other great mentor, though, in TV business, a guy named Bruce Paisner, who's the CEO and president of the International Emmy Organization, a long-term Hearst executive. I mean, for years, he has just been a good friend of mine and a great leader and an incredibly gracious and wonderful sounding board. So those have been my mentors. And
So let's talk about certain business people who influenced your concept. Who affected how you look at running a studio, running a channel, bringing a U.S. property international?
What was great about the opportunities I've had, I was really there at the first wave of bringing these channels abroad. And we had Invent It as we went along. So I hate to say this, but I often learned by other people's mistakes, people who may came a year or two before me, mm-hmm. or who were hired before I got hired. And at first, bringing these channels abroad, for a lot of people, this was a financial bath, much like it is.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
I'm stunned. I would have thought that this would have been a gold mine.
It took years to become a gold mine. It did. Now it's going to fade again because linear is fading.
But let's digress a little bit. How long of a process was it? Did this go from, gee, we're spending a ton of money and we're not seeing anything, to, wow, we put X number of years in and the money's just rolling in?
So no one will cop to it, but I'd say overall, longer than expected for a lot of people. A lot had to do with people started launching before the markets were even there.
Right.
So it seemed like a no-brainer. Cable and satellite, or cable big in the U.S., so it's going to be eventually in Europe, and it's going to be eventually in Asia.
Was it better to be early than late? Do you run into a competitive disadvantage? Or
for those people who hung in there, started early, had foresight and said, I'm going to look 5, 10, 15 years, of course they've done well. They have the best position in the market right now. So yes, and there were people, and I admire some, the Redstone for things like that, for hanging in there and wanting to just keep going at it. Those people had foresight. Not everyone else did.
How long did it take before this actually became profitable?
It depends on the channel and the market. Some people...
If I said 5 years, am I out of line? Or
5 years seemed to have been the normal business plan projection. But honestly, with some of the businesses I launched, we got into first-year profitability. Mm-hmm. Others took a lot longer. And still others, for other people, may not have made money to this day.
So let's talk a little bit about books. Everybody always loves this segment. I get requests all the time. Hey, what were the books that somebody recommended? So tell me some of your favorite books that either relate to this field or are wholly unrelated.
I'm a big fiction guy.
Uh-huh.
So I jotted down those guys, who's really influenced me throughout my life. When I was a young person, Jerzy Kosinski blew my mind. That was Being There and Painted Bird.
By the way, Being There eventually becomes the Peter Sellers movie.
Correct.
Painted Bird, I don't remember what became of that. But that was a big book.
Yeah, young boy who escaped the Holocaust and led a group of refugees, but gripping, intense. And at the time, there were not a lot of books like that other than nonfiction descriptions of what happened. I was really influenced as a teen by Garcia Marquez, 100 Years of Solitude. I still consider that my favorite novel. I love Philip Roth. I mean, I'm very happy Bob Dylan got the Nobel Prize.
Wait, let's go back before you... So again, same age, same demographic background. I was a little annoyed at Portnoy's complaint for writing my autobiography before I had a chance to write it. And I don't know if you had a similar
mind. I read it as a teenager.
Right. I was literally a teenager on the beach when I read it. And I was like, how is somebody allowed to even write this stuff? It's amazing.
And now, but look
at it. Hilarious. One of the funniest books I ever read. I don't know if it's today, if a 17-year-old picked up that book, if it would be as funny to them as it was to me.
It's not. But it established the genre. No one was talking with that kind of profanity personally about sex. And there would be no Woody Allen if it wasn't even for that book.
That's somewhat true. I could certainly see that progression.
There would be no Larry David for that book. I think he started that all. But then if you look at his transformation, if you look at some of his later ones, like Indignation, they could be two totally different human beings.
Right. What's the most recent book he just put out?
I guess, would it be Indignation? I mean, they just made that into a movie.
Then what was the one right before that?
Everyman.
Okay.
So these last several books have been thinner, sparer, moving. Plot Against America, you know, everyone's been pointing to that as what foreshadowed what happened last night.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he really was and is the most worthy author of the Nobel Prize. And one day he'll get his due. I really like a French author, Michel Houellebecq, who's just mind-blowing and just his last couple, not so much. But
What's your favorite title of his?
I like a lot of people like Atomized, but mine is Platform. Is a novel he wrote, which really blew me away. Just I think he's fearless. He broke a lot of norms with that. Mm-hmm. A nonfiction book which really moved me, and I gotta say, probably really, I'd recommend it to anyone, is Zaytoun by Dave Eggers. This is about someone who survived Hurricane Katrina, Muslim man. What happened to him? Muslim building contractor who.
And this is nonfiction.
Nonfiction.
Zaytoun.
That's the fellow's last name. Great guy who was saving people at businesses and treated quite unfairly by the authorities because of who he was. That moved me.
One can imagine how that plays out.
That moved me. I just read Jonathan Safran Foer's new novel, Here I Am. Mm-hmm. I liked a lot, especially as it went on. It was very thought-provoking. Sacred Games is a Man Booker Prize runner-up from India by Vikram Chandra. That really
someone else
me.
Referenced Vikram Chandra, and I don't remember who it was. I'll have to take a closer look.
Great novel, and I really liked it. Really, I still think about it. It was so creative. The Yiddish Policemen's Union, the Chabon book, where it's an alternative history.
My wife read it. I haven't gotten to it.
After the war, World War II, Israel is not created, and instead the U.S. gives a homeland to Jews in Sitka, Alaska.
Right.
And how that all develops, and there's a fuse on it because the it's going to end after, I think it was 50 years, the gift of the franchise. So, but the world he created and the way he wrote, that book really meant a lot.
You know, there's been a run of alternative historical realities. The frame of reference for me has always been Philip K. Dick's Man in the High Castle, which a talk show host wakes up and is surprised to discover that World War II didn't play out the way we all recall. The U.S. lost to Germany and Japan, who have divided up the U.S. and are in the process of absorbing it to the parent company countries. And it's just – he's infamous for multiple layers of reality. But I love the concept.
Did you
of
see
those.
The show on Amazon?
I just started watching it a couple of months ago, and
it's unbelievable.
I
thought it was so good.
The quality of how it looks in the set design, and they really did an amazing. You could see there's some real money behind. We were talking about this earlier. They are not afraid to spend money on stuff, and that made the
difference. Because you know what? If you cheaped out on showing graphically what this alternative universe
it would
like.
Not have worked.
It would have failed.
You had to get a certain tone and a certain tenor, and the way it looks and feels and the way they do the maps and some of the iconography and the way the Nazi symbols are Nazi symbols, but it's not just black and red swastikas.
Right, it's integrated in the U.S. flag.
It's much more interesting and sophisticated than...
I think they nailed it. I mean, to me, that after seeing that, that's when I really started developing this theory. It's not original, I guess, that in that kind of format, with that kind of money, where you're not doing commercials, where you could do a 118-minute episode or whatever, they're just taking storytelling to a whole different place than basic cable, and certainly that broadcast can. Season 2 is coming out in December.
I was going to say, I'm almost done with season 1, and I'll binge it over the holidays and get ready for season 2. I've also loved some of the comedies, like Catastrophe.
It's all great.
Which is so interesting, and just not anything you would ever see on U.S. television.
No.
And I used to love these shows on BBC, like Coupling was this hilarious. You know, I just thought Friends was kind of toothless. It was just a randy, funny version of a uniquely British version of six young people engaging in everything they engage in. And they tried to do in the United States, and they just destroyed
it. No, it failed.
And then they actually turned that concept. If you've watched the Matt LeBlanc show episodes, it's about bringing over this really intelligent, well-written show from London in a boys' school, with all the class issues and everything else, and they bring it over to the U.S., and they make the headmaster into a hockey coach. Like, they couldn't dumb it down anymore. And then it's about the battle between the writers, the actors. And it's very much a, I loved Larry Sanders' show. This is very much along the, but I'm supposed to be asking you about books, not talking about television.
It's great.
Any other books you want to reference, nonfiction or fiction?
That's
a good run.
Yeah, I'm reading the Association of Small Bombs. Is that the... novel that was also, I think, a Man Booker runner-up. Was it this year or that last year? I just started it.
See, I wish I had more time for novels. 90% of what I read is nonfiction, or biography, or history, or market related. But I have a list of novels I'm just dying to see.
Well, you know, the travel I travel so much abroad, 12-hour, 14-hour plane rides. This is the only reason I've been able to read, and this is the only reason that I literally is flying back from Asia, and I'm not boasting, or maybe I sound pathetic, but I watched all 10 episodes of Man in the High Castle, all of them, on one trip back. I watched 10 hours worth of it. I couldn't put it down.
That's fascinating. Are you using physical books, or is it a Kindle or
something? No, I really, if it's important to me, especially fiction, it's going to be my old school little thing. I'm always only going to use the physical book.
I have a Kindle in my briefcase. But if I'm home and I want to read something, like you're traveling, I used to go on vacation. I'd bring 8 books. I'd read 4 of them.
Yeah.
You're dragging like a whole suitcase full of books. Now, that doesn't happen. You go on vacation, you bring a Kindle, but it's still not the same as a physical book.
It's not the same. And I like finishing the book. I like putting in my bookshelf. I've been doing that for years.
Right.
You know, in some ways, I suppose, it's like people who do deals and they want their Lucite cube. You know, it's your Lucite cube. You read it. I remember I read it. And I hope we don't lose that.
Yeah. All right. So beyond books, we talked about what's changed in the industry. What do you think the next shifts are going to be in streaming video, video on demand, and just generally in entertainment and content creation?
So I was at a conference recently, and I was in a minority. They said, will TV be all apps?
And apps, all apps.
All apps. And I said yes, and people said that's far-fetched. But let me explain by what I mean. Right now, we use proprietary non-internet technologies to not stream but transmit cable to your household.
Broadcast or right.
These are not scalable, efficient technologies. They're going to come under more pressure as the markets decline because you
just because of cost.
Because of cost and because of scale, because less and less people are going to be using it.
Right.
Now, streaming is it's self-improving every day. If you want to improve your cable network overnight and do a whole bunch of things, you may have to take out boxes, rip out cords. Internet's very different. It's becoming very robust. So the future, which I think is not too long from now, everything will be streamed. It may look like you can watch CNN, and it looks like linear and whatever, but soon, I think the whole technological base of TV will be based on IP protocol. So in a sense, that is an app. All right? You may not have to download it. It doesn't look like you buy it in the iTunes.
But it's not the same.
It's not the same, and it's IP, and that will lead us to a whole world where you'll be able to do amazing things with your channel, not even watch a channel. You'll be able to watch the on-demand elements, the social commentary elements. I think that's where it's all going. So that's why I say the world is going to be looking more like apps than it looks today.
And my last two and favorite questions, if a millennial or recent college grad came to you and said, hey, I'm interested in a career in television and video and content, what sort of advice would you give them?
I'd say digital social marketing is whoever figures that out and knows it the way Don Draper knew advertising is going to do really well in life, because that conventional way of advertising is gone with that next generation. That's a big business, I think. And then content creation and just really being on the cutting edge of that will continue. People are always going to want to see good TV, and the U.S. tends to excel at that. The difference between us and a lot of other places in the world aren't as big as it was 20 years ago, because the technology is now closing that gap and allowing people to, you know, go into a Mac and create things that would have required a $20 million investment in an Avid and a whole bunch of other things back 10 years ago. So I think those are the two areas.
And then my final question, what is it that you know about content, video, overseas licensing today that you wish you knew when you started this career path 20 plus years ago?
I would have gone much, much, even though we knew the internet, everyone says, is going to eat our lunch. It eventually will. I would have personally gone much bigger into all of these stocks back in the mid-90s.
Despite the dot-com crash.
Yeah. You got to hang in there if you believe, because I think, so we always, my whole career, have been talking about how the internet's really going to change everything. But now we're seeing it. And I think people thought it's going to profoundly change everything. But in my view, in the next, I don't know if it's 5, 10, or 15 years, it is going to be everything. And
so how far along the transition from analog to digital, from, I love the expression, meat space,
yes,
to online, how far along that process are we?
So, you know, there used to be the last mile. Then right. There was the last 100 feet. There's the last 10 feet, which was about 6, 7 years ago. And then that was breached. Now I call it the last 3 seconds of patience.
Uh-huh.
That's it. Because now you get these apps in your TV. It's kind of confusing, but each new generation TVs makes it a lot more seamless. The minute becomes entirely, you don't even have to think about what you're pressing, and you don't know if it's Netflix or if it's CNN Live.
Uh-huh.
That changes everything. And you know what? That's the easiest part. It took trillions of dollars to wire the world.
Sure.
With fiber optics. That was the last, got you the last mile. Then to get you to that last 10 feet, people were digging up your driveways. I remember Fios was in my house for a week and a half. I don't know how they ever made money off of putting me onto Fios. But now this last thing, this is happening right now. And someone's going to really figure out how to integrate all of these experiences seamlessly over your television set, over your devices. And it's game over and it's a different game then. That's where it's all going.
Bruce, thank you for doing this and being so generous with your time.
My pleasure.
We've been speaking with Bruce Tuckman. He was with MGM International, AMC Global, and a number of other channels he helped bring worldwide. If you enjoy this conversation, be sure and look up an inch or down an inch on Apple iTunes, and you could see the other 100-something-plus shows we've done. Be sure and write us. We love to hear your comments, feedbacks, and suggestions. Write to us at mibpodcast@bloomberg.net. I would be remiss if I did not thank Taylor Riggs, our booker, and Michael Batnick, our head of research, for helping to produce everything. You've been listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.
Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, committed to bringing higher finance to lower carbon, named the most innovative investment bank for climate change and sustainability by The Banker. That's the power of global connections. Bank of America, North America, member FDIC.